It was a big night across the country and here in Idaho as well, as numerous statewide races were up for grabs. We just spoke with Governor-elect Brad Little, as well as Diana Lachianda, newly elected Ada County Commissioner. And Governor-elect Brad Little won over Democrat challenger Paulette Jordan. He got about 60% of a statewide vote. There are also other races and results, though, to get to. Joining me live in studio to talk about all of this are Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, political analyst Justin Vaughn, and Jacqueline Kettler, an assistant professor of political science at Boise State University. And Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press is joining us live by phone. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks. Yep.
Well, it was a long night for a lot of people. So let's get right to it. Let's start with Lieutenant Governor race. This was a close race throughout the night. Ultimately, Republican Janet McGeehan won with 50% of the vote over Kristen McCollum's, I think it was about 40%. Here she is on Idaho Public Television last
night. Thank you so much for all that you've done to help us be successful in our campaign. I cannot wait to become your next lieutenant governor and work to protect all the traditional conservative values that we all hold so dear to ourselves. So thank you so much.
And that was Lieutenant Governor-elect Janet McKeon giving her acceptance speech last evening. I want to start out just talking about this race in general, because there was a lot of momentum behind Kristen McCollum's campaign. And she got great support in Ada County. We have the rest of the state, though, that plays into this. So, Justin, how does all of that, you know, play out in a race like this? I mean, is this typical Idaho election?
I think what we saw in this race, this is going to be the same story in most of the races. There's a couple where this is not the case necessarily, but you saw Democrats voting for Democrats, Republicans voting for Republicans. The numbers in these statewide congressional races are almost identical across most of those races, and so unless there's something really unique or extraordinary in a race to shake things up significantly, you're going to see this kind of Republican winning by 20 points time and time again. And there was a lot of momentum coming in, and McCollum got a lot of Democratic votes, but there wasn't that kind of change factor or wild card that made independents split in a unique way going more to her, or made a significant shift of Republicans decide to leave their candidate, who represented their interests pretty well, and go choose a different person.
And, you know, in the beginning of the night, as results were coming in, Kristen McCollum had more votes than Paulette Jordan was. And we were hearing this kind of over and over again. Was that surprising, Jacqueline?
No, you know, I think that McCollum had kind of this strong fiscal conservative element in addition to these other kind of core Democratic positions. And so that may have helped a little bit among some of the unaffiliated voters, perhaps. But I'm curious on whether she pulled some more Democratic votes that maybe Jordan did not. Jordan didn't have support of some of those establishment Democrats, and whether or not they voted for her in the end is kind of will be an interesting question for us to kind of evaluate moving forward.
And I think you can see that in the Ada County numbers. I was really struck by Paulette Jordan barely carried Ada County, a county she won big in the Democratic primary. I mean, she won the Ada County vote last night by only about 2,000 votes. You contrast that with Cindy Wilson, the state superintendent candidate, who carried Ada County by something like 34,000 mm-hmm. votes. So that tells you that there were quite a few voters who made their way down the ballot to superintendent, having made the conscious decision that they were going to support a Democrat but not support the Democratic gubernatorial candidate. And presumably, almost all of those voters went with Brad Little.
And Betsy, having covered politics for so long in Idaho, were you surprised by the turnout with this election last night with Lieutenant Governor?
I thought McGeehan actually got a bigger margin over Collin than I expected her to. But it's probably important to remember that Collin was a first-time candidate. She was a newcomer completely to Idaho politics, with a background in the military and in high tech, whereas Janice McGeehan served in the legislature for 10 years, was the chairwoman of the House Health and Welfare Committee, is kind of a known quantity in Idaho politics. And given where Collin was coming from, which basically was nowhere coming into this, she ran a pretty hard-fought grassroots campaign, and it really sounds like she is building towards something in the future. And that this might be a new prospect for the Democrats in the future. Some of the things that she said, quote, in her concession speech, quote, "We're changing the face of Idaho. It doesn't stop here and now. This may just be the end of a chapter, but tomorrow I start again." So I think we may still see more from Kristen Collum.
And what a leap to honestly come in first time and go for lieutenant governor. And you make a good point, Betsy, to get the number of votes that she got instead of maybe going for a local election.
Absolutely. And this, she really did run a kind of a classic statewide grassroots campaign where she traveled and traveled and, you know, hit the roads, which was kind of different from Janice McGeehan, who occasionally flew to one part of the state or the other. So there was quite a contrast there, and Collum showed herself to be a really hard worker as a campaigner. So there could be more to see from her in the future.
Let's talk about the congressional district seats. Both of those up for grabs. 20-year incumbent Mike Simpson won 60% of the vote. I don't think there was any real surprise to that. First-time congressional seat, former state legislator Russ Fulcher won with 62% of the vote. Let's quickly listen to a snippet from his acceptance speech.
I want to just promise you, fellow Republicans, please know that we take this very, very seriously. Your Republicans will stand for the foundation of constitutional principles, and we will work together with honor to represent you and Idaho both locally and on a worldwide stage. I appreciate you. Thank you.
I would say no real surprise that Fulcher won. It's the last time I believe we had a U.S. representative Democrat was Walt Minnick. And
right, but that wasn't really that long ago.
That wasn't that long ago, right?
The first district has become more and more heavily Republican and conservative in recent years, as has pretty much all of North Idaho.
And that's where he got a lot of the vote.
Well, I mean, that's where the first district goes. It comes through part of Boise and goes all the way up north, where the second district cuts through part of Boise and goes all the way over to the east. Remember that Fulcher is succeeding Raul Labrador, a very conservative Republican who endorsed Fulcher, and that his Democratic opponent, Christy McNeil, was another first-time candidate who had not run for office before at all. I was a little surprised, though, at the Republican election night watch party last night when they decided to call the race and claim victory for Fulcher when only one precinct had been reported yet.
It's kind of counting your eggs before they hatch, right? You brought up a good point, though, Betsy, about how District 1 is basically, you know, configured. We have a census coming up in 2 years. And Justin, how could this potentially play out in 2 years when, I mean, is there any potential of these boundaries shifting at all with our congressional districts and with our population?
I don't think in Idaho. I mean, the only way that they would you would have to really purposefully draw a district designed specifically to elect a Democrat for a Democrat to win in Idaho, right? Both of our winning congressional candidates last night got 60% of the vote, or 61 in one case, I think 63% in the other case. Like, those are major victories. Unless you like draw a circle around the city of Boise,
And not going to happen.
Yeah, right. And so, which would be just a different kind of gerrymandering, right? Now, in other states, certainly some of the Democratic gains that we're seeing will make a big difference in other states. And you'll see states, you know, districts, congressional districts redrawn. But in Idaho, until we're not a state where 60% of the population are Republicans, then there's no way that you would draw a fair district that would probably result in anything different than what we would have right now.
And we want to talk now about a race that just got called about, what, less than 3 hours ago. And, Kevin, this was state school superintendent. Mm-hmm. This was a close race. Walk me through this.
Well, it was a close race. I kind of go back to what Justin was saying a couple of minutes ago. I mean, what you saw and what it boiled down to is both Sherry Ibarra and Cindy Wilson really performed well in areas where you would expect the respective candidates to perform well. Cindy Wilson ran very well in Ada County. She ran maybe better than expected in Bannock County. She won Bonneville County. Blaine County, she won fairly big. Latah County, you know, with the exception of Bonneville County, we're talking about, you know, pretty strong Democratic areas. Where Sherry Ybarra won and won big were in areas such as Kootenai County, which is becoming a real Republican stronghold, and Canyon County, which has always been pretty reliably Republican. So it was a close race as we watched the numbers. But as we watched the numbers late into the night by about 1, 2 in the morning, and you could see that there were still a lot of numbers, a lot of precincts that hadn't been counted in Canyon and Kootenai County. It started to look like, you know, the map really favored Ybarra. And, you know, I did an analysis piece on this race and all the races. And my kind of rhetorical question was, you know, when will Democrats win their next statewide race? Because they had a lot of things going for them in this race. Cindy Wilson ran a pretty credible campaign. She was the beneficiary of a couple of expensive advertising campaigns that I thought were fairly, you know, effective ads. She got some endorsements that kind of cross ideological lines, like Frank Vandersloot, the CEO of Melaleuca. She had a lot of favorables going into the election, and Sherry Ybarra won by 17,000 votes. She tripled her margin of victory from 2014. So this is a race the Democrats could have won. Some might argue it's a race the Democrats should have won, and they didn't. And I think there's, you know, if you're the Idaho Democratic Party, I think there's a little bit of a reckoning there.
So where does the Democratic Party go from here? Because this was the race to watch in a lot of regards last night. Jacqueline?
Yeah, and especially with expected higher Democratic turnout than usual with things like Prop 2 on the ballot and other, you know, just national politics. Yeah, we would have expected this to be kind of the good race for Democrats to really pursue. But we did see Democrats pick up a couple legislative seats and make inroads in a couple other districts. So not major gains, but maybe some movement there to kind of lay out some hope for, you know, building and getting into that Republican supermajority in the future.
And what about this idea? We had Jasper Lacalzi on from College of Idaho on yesterday, and he spoke about this race, the Cindy Wilson Ybarra race, and he said this should not be a partisan race. This should be about a competence. And how does that play into it, though, when you have that R and you have that D and this is Idaho?
Well, the political science of it isn't just Sorry, Betsy. It's not just a partisan issue. Most states don't even elect a state superintendent. In most cases, it's an appointed position. So, you know, you could argue that, you know, why are we electing a state school superintendent? Most states don't.
Betsy?
Yes, on the other hand, we have partisan elected county coroners.
So, so we have that,
too. We have a number of positions in our government that are partisan for no apparent reason that appear to be about competence. Heck, we have a partisan elected secretary of state who oversees elections. That is kind of how our politics work here. I think that Sherry Ybarra won this race after running a fairly weak campaign compared to the kind of campaign that Wilson ran, which goes back to Kevin's point about perhaps this was a race the Democrats should have won. Why didn't they?
And Justin?
I think that the math in the political math in the state just kind of is the answer there, that you know, just about everything that was in the Democrats' favor on this race, it was designed in a way that, or worked out in a way that you know, you couldn't ask for a better situation. You had all the factors that Kevin mentioned a moment ago, from Frank Vandersloot getting involved to a kind of minor blue wave happening nationally to extremely competent challenger who ran a really great campaign and basically dueled to a near tie and simultaneously dramatically outperformed all of the other statewide candidates in her party. And so very successful in that sense, just not successful enough. And so
and coattails do have an effect. I think if Paulette Jordan had polled in the mid-40s, like I think some of us expected she would do better than she did last night, I think that makes the path a lot easier for Cindy Wilson. The fact of the matter is Paulette Jordan came in at 38%, a little bit lower than A.J. Polukov did 4 years ago. That makes it really tough for a Democrat down ticket to pick up votes when folks have supported the Republican at the top of the ticket.
The two statewide propositions on the ballot likely helped increase voter turnout yesterday. Voters chose to expand Medicaid here in Idaho. Voters turned down the option to legalize historical horse racing. Proposition 2, which would provide health care coverage for more than 60,000 Idahoans in the Medicaid gap, passed with a 60% return. Our reporter, Seth Druzin, stopped by the Close the Gap headquarters last night, and he talked with some of the people who will be directly affected by this vote. He spoke with Nicole Stoll. She and her husband fell into the gap after he was laid off a few years ago.
3 years without medical care is kind of a hard thing. And during that time, both my mom and my sister were diagnosed with breast cancer. And so it was recommended that we all get tested for the BRCA cancer gene. And we found that I was positive. So there's a lot of things that I should be doing. But while I'm in the gap, I can't do any of them, really. They're too expensive. Even doing some of the regular six-month testing and that kind of stuff is hard to do. And so I have to wait for grants and apply for things to be able to try to get that stuff done.
Let's turn to our panel to talk more about Propositions 1 and 2. Back with us are Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, political analyst Justin Vaughn, and Jacqueline Kettler, an assistant professor of political science at Boise State University. And Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press is on the phone with us. When you hear that from a citizen like Nicole, it seems to put it in perspective as to why we saw such a big majority vote for this. And Jacqueline, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean, I think this issue is personal for a lot of people in Idaho. They had a friend, their family, themselves, coworkers that were affected by this. And so I think that motivated a lot of people to vote for it, in addition to other benefits that seem like would come through, whether it's, you know, decreasing health care costs for the state or for individuals. But yeah, I think there was a lot of people who viewed this as it was personal.
And Betsy, how does this play in now that we head into the legislative session? And we just had Governor-elect Brad Little on, and he said, you know, this is law now, but legislature has to, I believe, appropriate this is the word that he used. So what happens next, even though this did get approved?
Well, according to the law, I mean, this is the law. What mm-hmm. happens next is that the state has to make application to federal officials to expand Medicaid, and then the legislature has to appropriate funds for that. I did speak last night with Representative John Vanderwater, who is the House Majority Caucus Chair and who has been one of the leading voices against Proposition 2, and he was conceding defeat. He said when the voters pass something 60-40, the legislature can't just not do it. He acknowledged they're going to need to implement it. He said he's already reached out to the Idaho Hospital Association, which was a leading advocate of the measure, and to health and welfare officials for information about, you know, how Idaho can implement and what should be in Idaho's Medicaid expansion plan. I think it's very clear that Idaho is going to expand Medicaid and the legislature is going to go along. Now, there may be some details they want to tinker with around the edges, but I think there will be great resistance to that given the huge margin of approval for the citizen initiative on an issue that the legislature has failed to act on for the past 6 years.
Go ahead, Kevin.
That margin really does matter, like Betsy said, because before the election, you did have some legislators suggesting that if Medicaid expansion passes, it's going to create pressure to fund the expansion and the state's bill to expand Medicaid versus funding education, the fifth year of the career ladder to raise teacher salaries, for example. I suspect if Representative Vanderwater, who's a member of House leadership, if that's an indication, what Betsy was just talking about, it's going to be really hard for legislators to not find the money. Mm-hmm. And I think if this had been a closer election, you might have had legislators saying, you know, do we really want to put our money here? Maybe the mandate from the voters wasn't as clear. 60-40 is hard to argue with.
And, you know, Representative Vanderwood right here on this program said one of his biggest concerns was the money. And, you know, and I'm quoting him a bit, but basically his whole argument was, if we had that kind of money, we could do this. We don't have that kind of money. But Kevin, back to your point, because this passed so handily, they have to find it.
It puts more onus on the legislature to find the money, especially because and Betsy, correct me if I'm wrong, because you've covered this much more closely than I have. A lot of the cost to the state is going to be the kind of upfront ramping up into Medicaid expansion. And that's theoretically money that could be drawn from rainy day accounts.
Absolutely. Plus, I mean, as far as if we had that kind of money, we'd do it now. I mean, when we expand Medicaid, the federal government in taxes that people in Idaho are already paying covers 90% of the cost. The state has to kick in 10%. If Idaho were to try to provide that same kind of service and coverage without expanding Medicaid, it would have to cover 100%, not 10%.
And that's a little bit of a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Justin, how much did this grassroots effort with Proposition 2, do you think, made a difference? And I know as this campaign moved forward, I mean, there was the argument that, well, they're getting big money. It didn't start that way.
No, it didn't. I think the real victory for the group that kind of spearheaded this effort was in getting it on the ballot. That was the hurdle, the highest hurdle. Once it was on the ballot and it was worded in a way that people could understand, it didn't surprise me at all that it passed with this large margin. You know, there have been statewide surveys that have shown more than 70% of people support this idea. And so the fact that 60% still voted for it makes a lot of sense. But it was never guaranteed that they were going to be able to get it on. It was never guaranteed that they were going to be able to then win the kind of framing message battle to, you know, avoid this somehow being viewed as some left-wing agenda, mm-hmm. right? And kept, I think, heavy financial opposition out of the state, which allowed them to keep those margins, you know, closer to that 70% or so who like the idea than actually coming to the polls and you know, mm-hmm. giving their stamp of approval.
So Proposition 1, this was save historical horse racing. This did not pass. And I have to say, and I've said this numerous times on this program, we have talked about this numerous times on this program. And I, every single time, learned something that I didn't know about it. Was that part of the issue? There seemed to be a lot of tension and he said, she said, and arguments. How did that, do you think that played into this or people just not really understanding it?
Yeah, I think there was some still confusion on exactly what the ballot measure was going to do. The wording may be a little difficult, something Justin and I spoke about before. And so I think some people in those situations are a little more likely to vote no when they don't know the benefits they'd get from voting yes. So that may have played a role for some voters.
And Betsy, you've covered this, and how do you think some of these grandfather clauses in this potentially played into it when we talk about, you know, the Greyhound racing in Post Falls? Because, you know, that was something that I think a lot of people were surprised about, that could have been a part of this.
Right. And the way that the backers of the initiative framed it was that it was really about horse racing at Loyola Park. And I think if that had been the case, it probably would have passed. I think there's a lot of support for live horse racing at Loyola Park, but because it had implications for other areas of the state, and in particular because an existing loophole in state law that grandfathers in gambling at the Greyhound Park in Post Falls would have meant that these machines could have then been turned on and added in unlimited numbers up there as well, in a place where there's never been horse racing, added to the confusion. And there was already a ton of confusion about this, about what exactly it did. And in the end, there just weren't enough voters who felt comfortable with it for it to pass.
And
it was fairly close.
It was. And so, Kevin, I want to talk about another initiative that we learned about this morning that did not pass. Not a good day for the College of Western Idaho.
Right. CWI was seeking $39 million to build a new facility. They were seeking a plant facilities levy, which is a little bit different than a bond issue. And the long and the short of it is, it needed a 55% supermajority to pass. It got 54.9%. They cleared the 55% mark in Ada County. They didn't get it in Canyon County. So narrowly failed. And, you know, I don't know what CWI does from here, because the idea of going with the plant facilities levy was designed to avoid having to pass a bond issue, which in Idaho requires a 2/3 supermajority. That's really tough to get, especially in a general election where you've got this huge turnout. So this was kind of a scale back in terms of the proposal. So I don't know where they go from here. I mean, it's a growing community college.
And there's a growing need.
Right. I mean, you know, they've got students upon students coming onto that campus, so we'll see what their next move is.
I want to thank.
And that levy failed by only 144 votes. That is really a squeaker. That is awfully close. So yeah. I can't see CWI just giving up on this now. It was a health science building. They have a pressing need. There's a need for nurses. I think we're going to hear more about this.
And they could conceivably come back with another levy as early as March. So we probably have not heard the last of this.
That is true. I want to thank all of you for joining me today. I know it was a long night for everyone, so I do appreciate all of your time. Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, political analyst Justin Vaughn, Jacqueline Kettler, an assistant professor of political science at Boise State University, and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Thanks for all of your guys' input. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.